Today is June 10th, correct? June 10th. We are up to page 90, Perek Chof, chapter 20. Last week we discussed Lot and his daughters, and now we move on, and we have one more episode before the birth of Yitzchak. Since Hashem told Avraham that Yitzchak would be born, there have been three episodes. There was the bris, the circumcision. There was the angels appearing to Abraham. There was the destruction of Sodom. And now the final episode before the birth of Yitzchak is going to be Abraham's traveling south and going to a place which will later be named Be'er Sheva. Hasn't been named that yet. And having our first encounter with Avimelech, king of the Plishtim, the Philistines. This is the first of many meetings between the Jews and the Plishtim and the Philistines. And so here we need to give our attention to this first meeting and what's it all about, and to understand where this meeting fits in as being a prelude to the birth of Yitzchak. You see, the other events, we've already explained each time why they were necessary. The circumcision itself being a bris, being a covenant between us and Hashem. Avraham showing that chesed, kindness, was more important to him than his own physical pain. And we showed how that related to the birth of Yitzchak. The destruction of Sodom, we talked about how Sodom, that Yitzchak could not coexist in a world with Sodom. And now we have to understand where this fits in. And of course, the destruction of Sodom comes with it Lot and his daughters and all that went on with that. So here, beginning from the beginning of the chapter, Pasuk Aleph, verse 1. Vayisam Misham Avraham Arzah, Negev Avram traveled from there. Where is there? Where had he been? He had been in Hebron. Elone Mamre. He had been in Hebron. So now he's traveling south. Vayeshev ben Kadesh uvein Shur. And he dwelled between Kadesh and between Shur. Vayagar Bigror. And he visited in Gerar. So he's between Kadesh and Shur, which are two different places. And he's visiting in Gerar. Now, this place we will see later will be named Be'er Sheva. And we know Be'er Sheva is one of the furthest southern cities in Eretz Yisrael. Now, today's state of Israel extends, I don't have my map here, but today's state of Israel, I think I've explained this to you before, today's state of Israel extends all the way south to the arm of the Red Sea and the coastal city of Eilat. All of that southern area is not part of biblical Israel. Our claim to the land, the biblical claim we have to the land, does not include that entire southern tip of the current state of Israel. Our biblical claim to the land actually doesn't go much further south than Be'er Sheva. Be'er Sheva is almost as far south as the biblical land goes. Of course, our biblical claim to the east and to the north includes almost all of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. Right, so it's a tit for tat over there, but that southern area traditionally is the land of Edom, of the children of Esav. Be that as it may, Be'er Sheva, which is where Abraham goes, is a very historic city, and we will see the first part of that history right over here. Now, why did he travel? This is critical. Why did he travel? It doesn't tell us why. It says he left from there to the land of the south. Why did he travel?
Because
So what has just happened? Two things have just happened. Sodom has been destroyed, and Lot has had the episode with his daughters. So our sages tell us that these two events both contributed to Abraham's traveling. He left because Abraham's whole aim is to do kindness for people, and therefore he set up his tent on a road where people traveled. Abraham was a pit stop. He was a road stop, a rest stop on the road. And when people traveled and they needed a place to stay over a night or a place to get a good meal or just to wash up, Abraham's tent was the place. And so he liked to be on a busy road. When Sodom and the surrounding area was destroyed, all the traffic stopped. And so there was no purpose in Abraham being there anymore, and so he traveled away, south. A second reason he traveled, again, our sages tell us, Rashi quotes it, is because since Lot had had the relationship with his daughters, people then talked about it, and because of that buzz, shall we say, Abraham didn't want to be in the area, and so he traveled away. Both those things contributed to Abraham's moving away from that place. But there's something a little more significant, or I shouldn't say a little more significant, something on a deeper level, which we should take note of. How did Abraham get to Hebron in the first place? Let's review the travels of Abraham. He went from Haran, back in his homeland, and he traveled, which Haran is in current Iraq, which would be Babylonia, and he traveled southwest to Israel. And he entered the land of Israel, and he came to the area where Shechem was going to be, which is what the Palestinians call Nablus. And he was over there. And he traveled further south, and we pointed out he was trying to head towards Yerushalayim. That's where he wanted to be. He got, his travelings were derailed because there was a famine, and he had to go down to Egypt. So he went to Egypt. Then he came back and went back to the same place. And the Hashem appears to him there and tells him that, he goes back to where he had been.
Which is the last place.
Which is the last place, which is around the north of Jerusalem, around Shechem, and a little bit, actually a little further south than that, between Beis El and between the Ai. The Torah tells us where he was, and he's in the Jerusalem area, but to the north of Jerusalem. And his shepherds and Lot's shepherds get into a squabble. And what happens when they get into that fight?
They separate.
So Abraham tells Lot, we're going to have to separate. And what does Abraham say to Lot? If you go right, I'll go left. If you go left, I'll go right. Which we pointed out back then means, if you go south, I'll go north. If you go north, I'll go south. So Lot lifts up his eyes and chooses where?
Sodom.
Lot is attracted to Sodom. And that's where he goes, because of all the material wealth that Sodom offered. And then Hashem appears to Abraham and says, go to Hebron. Now, going to Hebron was in keeping with his promise to Lot. If you go south, I'll go north. If you go north, I'll go south. As Rashi says, I won't go too far away. I will be near you in case you need me. I'm not going to simply forsake you. We need to separate, but I will be in the area in case you need me. And in the end, Lot did need Abraham, because the four kings attacked the five kings. The five kings are the five kings, including Sodom, and defeated the five kings and took the people captive, including Lot. And so Abraham had to chase them up north and defeat the four kings and thereby save Lot from the four kings. So Lot's being in Sodom got him into hot water because the four kings attacked, and now Abraham had to save him. So he did. Now, here, we're still living in Hebron, the same thing occurs, only worse. Again, Lot needs Abraham, because Sodom is now going to be destroyed, and because Lot is in the city, Lot really should also be destroyed, but in the merit of Abraham, Lot is saved. So here it's not because Abraham gets on his horse and runs after him, but just the presence of Abraham saves Lot. And so Lot is saved a second time because of Abraham. This time because it was in a more supernatural way because of the angels, but he is saved because of Abraham. Why did Lot get into trouble both times? Both when the four kings defeated the five kings and when Sodom would be destroyed. Why did Lot need Abraham? Why was he in trouble? Because he was living in Sodom. And both times Lot needed Abraham to save him, it wasn't because anybody attacked Lot, it's because people attacked where Lot was. The four kings attacked Sodom and the surrounding cities. Lot was taken captive. Even though we pointed out back then that part of their goal was to take Lot captive, but the bottom line is they attacked the city of Sodom, Lot was in the city. The second time the city of Sodom is being destroyed, Lot is in the city. So Lot needs Abraham because of his mistake, because of his poor choice of where to live. Lot was attracted to the wealth of Sodom, but that was superficial, and that was a poor choice. And as a result, he gets into trouble not once, but twice. And both times, Abraham is there to save him. Once Sodom is destroyed, then Abraham doesn't need to be there to save Lot anymore. Because the whole reason why Lot was attacked or needed Abraham's help was because of his association with Sodom. Well, Sodom is no more. So therefore, Lot's getting into trouble is far less of a possibility, or a probability, shall I say. And so Abraham now has the luxury to travel because Sodom is destroyed. But it goes beyond that. It goes beyond that. Remember, we had the whole class about Lot and how Lot had the potential for being directly part of God's plan, to be directly connected to Abraham. And in the end, Lot failed. And that was manifesting that separation from Abraham and going to Sodom. And Lot gave up his place in eternity with the Jewish people. But Lot still had a role to play, as we pointed out, because Lot's great-great-great-granddaughters, Rus and Naamah, are going to join the Jewish people. Once Lot himself doesn't deserve to be part of the Jewish people directly, then it's going to be two of his descendants who are going to become converts, Rus from the country of Moab and Naamah from the country of Ammon, who will join the Jewish people. Lot and his daughters having the relationship creates the nations of Moab and Ammon. Once those two nations are created, essentially Lot becomes irrelevant. Until this point in the Chumash, Lot gets a lot of ink. There's a lot of discussion about Lot. Disproportionate, you would say, to who he had turned out to be. All the time he traveled with Abraham, all the Abraham saving Lot once, twice, the whole episode in Sodom, running away. There's so much about Lot, and now he's not discussed at all. Because he now literally falls off the face of history. Because he becomes irrelevant. He has served his purpose. He has created the two nations of Moab and Ammon. Those two nations are not irrelevant. Those two nations will eventually bring forth Rus and Naamah, and those two nations will also end up being a thorn in our side for all history. Until Mashiach comes, they are a thorn in our side. We have a tradition that even today, they are a thorn in our side, even though we don't know who they are, so we can't point them out. But we know that wherever we are in exile, Hashem makes sure that there are some of them near us to give us trouble. And so we are aware that they are of their existence. But Lot himself, becomes irrelevant. He lost his chance, and now he's off the face of history. And so, Abraham traveling away really has to do with Sodom being destroyed, and Lot's episode with his daughters, so now Lot is finished. Abraham's association with Lot becomes something which we don't need to know about anymore. It doesn't become important anymore. It was important until now. But now that that's finished, Abraham travels away. We, the readers of the Torah, the studiers of the Torah, we are now traveling away from Lot. We're finished with Lot. Lot is done. That's a story we read about, we understood it, we studied it, we have it in depth. Now we're finished with Lot, and we're on to the next chapter. Abraham, of course, endures. because Abraham endures even after his death. Abraham goes on, and we know that, and every day we mention his name in our davening 3 times a day. Okay, Abraham, Hashem is the God of Abraham. Again, Abraham, the shield of Abraham. Abraham goes on. Lot isn't mentioned, of course, because he's finished. So he goes south to Beersheba. Now, he goes to this place called Gerar. Now, it does not say here in the Torah that Gerar is one of the main cities of the Plishtim. In fact, it's not going to mention the name Plishtim this entire chapter. He will mention the name Plishtim in reference to Gerar and in reference to their king Abimelech later on, and also having to do with Abraham. But at this point tonight, we're not even going to see the name Plishtim, at least not over here. But you'll have to take my word for it. Later on, we will see that this is the place of the Plishtim. Now, before we go further, who are the Plishtim, the Philistines? We hear about the Philistines all the time. They come up in Nach, in the prophets, all over the place. Who are they? What is the Plishtim's ancestry? Who remembers from the Parshas Noach? Let's turn back. Hold your place. Hello.
Wrong place at the right time.
He can answer the question.
We changed it.
How'd you change
it? 7:30.
Okay.
Did you know that?
No.
Okay.
We're going to go to. Page 46. Bert, we are looking for the ancestry of the Plishtim. We're about to have Abraham's first encounter with the Plishtim, with the Philistines, and now we want to do is show the ancestry of the Plishtim. Who are they? Page 46. Start from verse.
Here you've got a diagram.
Yeah, but it's true. We have the diagram over there, but I want to show it to you in the verses because the words are going to be very important over here. Verse 13, Yud Gimel. Mm-hmm. Remember that Mitzrayim, we know as Egypt, is a nation, but Mitzrayim is also a person. And Mitzrayim was the second son of Ham. Ham being the son of Noach. So Noach's grandson is Mitzrayim. And Mitzrayim has offspring. So it says in 13, Yud Gimel, U'Mitzrayim yalad es Ludim ves Anavim ves Lehavim ves Naftuchim. Mitzrayim had 4 children, Ludim, Anamim, Lehavim, Naftuchim. Another further, Ves Pasrusim, Es Kastuchim. He had 2 more children, Pasrusim and Kastuchim. Asher Yotzatzix, Asher Yotzumi Sham, that came out from there, Pilishtim, Ves Kaptorim. Pilishtim and Kaptorim. So, Pilishtim came forth from Pasrusim and Kastuchim. Now, how does that happen? You said the words are very confusing. So, how does that happen that the Philistines came forth? Rashi tells us over here, in the name of Chazal, our sages, that Pasrusim and Kasluchim had a very liberal attitude. They engaged in wife trading. And Pasrusim and Kasluchim would exchange their wives, and from there came Pilishtim. So Pilishtim, the Philistines, are descendants of Mitzrayim. You want to say grandchildren of Mitzrayim, grandson of Mitzrayim. But Pilishtim meaning grandson of Mitzrayim, but in a very illegitimate way. 2 of the sons involved themselves in wife trading, and from there, as Rashi says, from the combination of the two, came Pilishtim. So Philistines have a very unholy origination. But they're related.
Do they know about it?
What's that?
Do they know about it?
Do they know that? They're related to Mitzrayim.
But they're also related to Abraham.
Well, we're all related eventually back to Noach. That's how they're related, right? They're not from shame. We're from shame.
Okay.
Right? But you're right. There, I mean, there's a relationship throughout. So the Philistines, the Pelishtim, come from a very, as I said, an unholy origination, and they are an offshoot of Mitzrayim. So this is significant. You might say that the Pelishtim are kind of the Mitzrayim is bad enough. Pelishtim seems to be like a twisted Mitzrayim. As whatever Mitzrayim is, Pelishtim seems to be an unholy result of Mitzrayim. So it is not by coincidence that here, when Avraham, back on page 90, when Avraham goes to the Pelishtim for the first time, it is not by coincidence that the same thing happens in the country of the Pelishtim as happens when he went to Mitzrayim. What happened when he went to Mitzrayim? Sarah was taken. Here, when he goes to the Pelishtim, Sarah is going to be taken again. That's not by coincidence.
So I guess from when Noah was around, they knew that you shouldn't marry, you shouldn't have...
It's one of the seven Noahide laws is all the arayos, which it's one Hebrew word. In English, we'd have to translate it as two, adultery and incest. And so that would be both. In fact, over here, it was both adultery and incest, because it was adultery because they were married, and it was incest because it was their brother's wives. And a sister-in-law is, a brother-in-law sister-in-law is incest, according to the Torah.
So after the flood, we forgot very quickly.
Not we, they. they were generally careful. People, we pointed this out with Mitzrayim, and we're going to point that out over here as well, that when Avraham came down to Mitzrayim, we showed this, several months ago when we talked about it. If you recall, remember we said that the fear was, and right here again, Avraham tells Sarah to say that he's her brother. Because if you say that I'm your husband, they will kill me to take you. Why do they have to kill him? Why can't they just take her without killing him? If they have the power to kill him by force, why don't they have the power to take her without killing him? But the answer is, because at least outwardly, they were careful with adultery. They did not engage in these practices openly. And that's because the flood terrified them. The flood, the primary punishment the flood was coming for was immorality in physical relationships. Because before the flood, they were engaged in all kinds of adultery, incest, homosexuality, etc., bestiality, all that stuff was going on before the flood. And the primary reason for the flood was for that sin. And so the nations of the world were careful with that whole immoral behavior, at least on a public scale. They were careful up until the time of Bilaam. And Bilaam, which we'll get to in a few months, Bilaam, as the non-Jewish prophet, ended up destroying the moral fabric of the world. And we'll show that when we get to the story of Bilaam. Incidentally, that's why we say that, a person says, what do you care what I do privately? What do you care how I act? It doesn't hurt anybody else. Murder hurts somebody else. Assault, battery, that hurts somebody else. If I choose to act immorally, how is that going to hurt anybody else? But we know that that's not so. That when you have an immoral society, eventually Hashem doesn't tolerate it, and that hurts everybody. And so it's worthwhile to note that was the primary sin that brought the flood about. There were other sins as well, but that was the main reason for it.
The seven laws of Noah were given at that time.
The seven laws of Noah were actually given to Adam.
To Adam?
Yep.
From the very beginning?
Yep. They're actually given then. But they are reiterated after the flood.
And why are they called the Noahites?
Because we're all the sons of Noah. And everybody comes from Noah. They would have been called the Adamite laws. But right now we can work ourselves back to Noah. He's who we're all from.
I have one question, because you said a brother and a sister-in-law, that would be incest. But if the brother dies...
Excellent.
then it's not.
Okay, so there's a special dispensation in the Torah. If one brother dies without children, then there's an obligation for the living brother to marry his wife, to the widow. That is a very interesting law because it's exactly what you said. In any other circumstance, it's incest.
Okay.
And only in that circumstance, not only is it not incest, but it's a mitzvah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, there's an alternative not to marry her and to do what is called chalitza, which is the process of taking off the shoe, and it's a whole ceremony to sever the bond between brother-in-law and sister-in-law. And that we'll discuss, hopefully, when we get to, if we have a chance to talk about the laws, when we get to that in the Chumash. The purpose of that law, the Torah itself tells us, is in order to carry on the name of the deceased brother.
One other question. Do the Philistines know that they're, I guess, they could they be called bastards?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do they know that it's actually who they are? You know, I mean, or do they deny it?
Well, the question is, who is they? Today's
Philistines.
The Philistines when?
In other words,
at this time,
the Philistines are actually
a nation.
A nation,
yeah.
Out of very illicit affairs.
Right.
You know.
Right.
All kinds of things. So, do they know that?
At this time?
That's where the role that they have is. Like that's who they are.
Do they know at this time in the Chumash?
Or do they deny it?
Your question is at this time in the Chumash. And it's at this in Abraham's time, do they know or deny it? That's your question?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer to it. We know it from the Torah. I don't know if the succeeding generations of the Plishtim knew it or not. Obviously the people who engaged in those practices knew it, but I don't know if the succeeding generations knew it or not.
Because when you have a bastard child, you know, the society knows. Nobody wants to marry them. So
were
there societal things with the
Plishtim? Well, the whole nation came from there. So, you know, anyway, most nations were insular. The whole notion of a world society didn't exist back then. Even today, I would argue, it doesn't really exist. Just look around at all the racial discrepancies there are. But certainly back then, there was no concept of it. Every nation was insular. Okay, so looking at Pasuk Beis, verse 2, Vayom Avram al Sarah ishto achosihi. Avram said concerning Sarah, his wife, she is my sister. Vayishlach Avimelech Melech Gerar. Avimelech, the king of Gerar, sent Vayikaches Sarah, and he took Sarah. Now here, a fascinating thing happens. What happened, we have to contrast the two stories. What happened when Paro took Sarah? On page 90. What happened when Paro took Sarah? He got sick. He got a terrible skin ailment. A type of tzaras, the worst type of tzaras possible. And not only that, he got beaten up by the angel every time he tried to get near Sarah. So Paro was clearly hurt and beaten and punished for having taken Sarah, which is a pretty significant level of divine intervention. And we always say, it's a common thing you hear that, well, if only every time I tried to sin, if when I tried to sin, I tried to reach for somebody else's money, if a little lightning bolt would come up and zap my hand, I wouldn't do it, right? I would stay away from it. But that's the whole struggle. The whole struggle is to keep it in mind when God is not striking us with the lightning. That's the whole struggle. If there would be lightning that would hit us every time we tried to do a sin, it would be a no-brainer, and then we wouldn't be rewarded for it. Paro got immediate punishment for trying to do a sin, but that's because he picked the wrong victim. He picked Sarah, and Hashem was not going to let anything happen to Sarah. Now, here, though, Avimelech gets an incredible revelation. Vayavo Elokim el Avimelech b'chalom b'alayla. God comes to Avimelech in a dream in the middle of the night. He gets a form of prophecy. He actually gets a communication from God. Vayom Eloni said to him, Hinchames al ha'isha shalakachta, behold, you are to die for the woman that you took. V'hi b'ulas bal, for she is... She's a married woman. She has a relationship with a man already. Now, the Torah tells us that Avimelech lo karav eleha. Avimelech had not gotten close to her. He had not actually done anything with her, even though it was the middle of the night. Vayomar, and he said, Hashem, hagoy gam tzadik taharog, a nation that is also righteous, you will kill? In other words, Avimelech, not only does he get a revelation from God, he has the chutzpah to deny God's accusation. He says, God, you're going to kill someone who's innocent? As if, what are you talking about? Me? What did I do wrong? Hello, he amar li achosihi. Behold, she said to me, hello, hu amar li achosihi. He said to me, she's my sister. Vihi gam hi amra achihu. And she said, he's my brother. Besam levavi, with the purity of my heart. Uvenikyon kapai, and the cleanliness of my palms. Asisi zos. I'm pure. I didn't do anything wrong. Vayomre lafo elokim bachalom. God said to him in a dream. Also I know that you did this with the purity of your heart. And I also held you back from sinning to me. That's why I didn't let you touch her. Because I knew that you did this out of the purity of your heart, which means you thought she was his sister. That's why I kept you from sinning. See, God says to Avimelech, I could have let you sin, and then I would have punished you. But because I knew that you didn't know all the facts, therefore I kept you from sinning. How did Hashem keep him from sinning? So we're going to see later on, Hashem brought upon Avimelech a terrible punishment. But the punishment itself kept him from the sin. What was the punishment? God closed up all or most of the orifices of the body of Avimelech and of his family members. All the genitalia of Avimelech and his family were closed up, and also their ears and their nose, I believe, the nostrils. I think the only orifice that was still working was the mouth and the eyes and orifice. Those are the only parts that were working. Everything else closed up. So obviously it made a physical relationship impossible. It also made many other things impossible, which made life very, very uncomfortable for all these people. So Hashem says to Avimelech, that's why I did that to you, to keep you from doing the sin. And I kept you from doing the sin because I know that you didn't know all the facts. Ve'atah, now, Hashem Eshes Ha'ish, returned the wife of the man. Ki Navihu, for he is a prophet. Avimelech, you should know, Abraham is a prophet. V'yispalel ba'adcha v'chyeh, and he will daven on your behalf and you will live. So return her to Abraham, for Abraham is a prophet, and he will know, as Rashi explains, he will know that you didn't really touch her, because he's a prophet, so he'll get that communication from me. And then he will daven for you and you will live. V'imeincha me'ishiv, and if you do not return her, da'kimos tamus, no, you will surely die. Atah b'chol ha'shalach, you and all that you have. So Avimelech gets a direct communication from Hashem with a direct order and a direct consequence if you don't follow through on my order. Go to Avram, return his wife to him, he will daven for you, and if not, you're going to die. Yeah.
How do you think a person, especially someone like Avimelech, would know that communication was from God?
Okay, that's a good question. That's a good question. Right? Yeah, we have the old, you have the famous, you know, the old joke where somebody says, "Well, I'll tell you the story." There was a, I had a principal in high school. Actually, you know, Rabbi Temler here in Atlanta. His father was my principal in high school. He still is the principal in near Israel in Baltimore, where I went to school, and. He told us that when he was a student, there was he had a fellow, a classmate, whose name was Moshe, who was very fond of himself, shall we say, and thought very highly of himself. And this Moshe liked to stay up late, ostensibly studying in the Beis Medrash, in the study hall, and he would do it after everybody went to bed, and he apparently put on airs about it. So one night, somebody hid behind one of the stems on one of the lecterns, and after everybody had left, it was quiet in the base medrash. He went, Moshe, Moshe. And the Moshe classmate said, Hineni, here I am. When the Talmud told us that, he enjoyed the story very, very much. So how does anybody know? Right, that's the question. But so the Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato, explains in Derech Hashem, in the way of God, that we who have never had prophecy, we think of prophecy as some kind of this shimmering vision, like this kind of a state of maybe half consciousness where you're not really clear about what's going on and you're kind of fuzzy and you have like this, you know, this dreamlike trance, and it's almost not that I would be able to speak from experience, but like someone who's on drugs or something, like somebody's right. There's some kind of a shikr, okay, but you know, like very very fuzzy what's going on. Yeah. That's the way we tend to think about what prophecy is, and then you kind of snap out of it, and now you got to figure it all out. So he writes that that's not so. Prophecy is an extremely clear communication. The clarity that you experience when you are a prophet at the time of the prophecy is like nothing else. It's more real than what we would call reality. And us walking around now, we'll say, this is reality. We're fully cognizant of what's going on. We're awake. We're conscious. We see what's going on. A prophet is seeing things much more clearly than the way we perceive things right now. And it's impossible to mistake prophecy for other things, except, he says, there's one exception. And that's why your question is a good question. The one exception is the very first time a person hears prophecy, sees prophecy. The very first time a person gets prophecy, it is possible to make a mistake and think that it is someone who loves you very much, someone who's very close to you. And that's what happened with the story of Shmuel, when he gets his first prophecy ever from Hashem, he thinks it's his mentor, Eli, who's calling him. It's the middle of the night, and he wakes up, and he goes to Eli and says, yes, you called? And Eli says, no, it wasn't me, go back to bed. So he goes back to bed, and this happened several times before Eli tells Shmuel, no, next time you hear your name called, say, Hineni Hashem, here I am, Hashem. Because it is God calling you. And that's in fact what it was Hashem calling him. And we'll talk about Shmuel when we get to Shmuel. And the other example of that is Moshe at the burning bush. Moshe himself at the burning bush did not know that it was Hashem at first. And the Ramchal writes that Moshe heard a voice. He thought it was his father Amram, which would have been startling because Amram was in Mitzrayim, if he was still alive. I don't even know if he was still alive at the time. And Moshe was in Midian at the time. So that would have been pretty unbelievable. But that could happen the first time the person hears prophecy, because the prophecy is out of love. And the prophecy is coming from Hashem, and it's such a beautiful communication. And the love a person feels from Hashem at the time of the prophecy is so intense, a person, if it's the first time they're ever getting it, could think that it is their parent or something like that, or their mentor, or somebody who really loves them. I suspect that over here Avimelech could not have made that mistake, because this communication was one of stern warning and ordering and consequence. So I suspect that over here it was much more clear that it was from Hashem. Yes.
Well, Avimelech was king of the Philistines.
Yes.
And so had they, at this point, accepted Abraham's God as their God?
Okay, so that's a very good question as well. And how did he get prophecy in the first place?
Yeah.
That's a very good question. Okay, we're going to talk about that. Yeah.
No, that's right.
Same question. Okay, good.
But, you know, now he's hearing God. He knows Abraham and what he does. How could he not then have a belief in, that there's
okay.
one God.
Okay. The Rambam Maimonides explains that in the days of old, when idolatry was real, he explains that the nations, almost all the nations, did not reject Hashem. It's not that they rejected Hashem. We do find that Paro says, Mi Hashem asher shma b'kolo. Who's this Hashem that I need to listen to him? He rejects Hashem totally, which is why Hashem Hashem doesn't have personal vendettas, but almost what we would call if we were going to dumb it down to our terms, we would call a personal vendetta against Paro. The whole point of the 10 plagues is Hashem is telling Paro, you're asking who I am? By the time I'm finished with you, you're going to know full well who I am. You'll have no questions anymore. If you don't know who I am, then listen up. You'll find out. That's what Hashem does to Paro. But everybody else does not reject Hashem. The Rambam writes, what happens is that people understand that there is a creator of the world, of the universe. But they think that, well, let's first say what is true and then what they make a mistake. We know that Hashem has given great power to various objects. For example, the sun. The sun is an object with tremendous power, and we today understand that power better than they did in the past, because we know the science of the whole thing, how far away the sun is, and yet how much power it's giving off, etc., 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 and the level of, like, comparing it to an atomic bomb, and how it's, like, incredible, the amount of hydrogen bomb, how much what's going on in the sun, on the sun's surface, in order for it to generate the light and the heat that it does. It has tremendous power. The moon has tremendous power. What it does with the tides and everything like that, we know that these things have power. The rain has tremendous power. The oceans have tremendous power. Mountains have tremendous power. Trees have tremendous power. Animals, various animals have tremendous power. We know this to be true. And we know, since we believe in Hashem, that Hashem has put some strength into these objects. But these objects are inanimate. They don't make their own decisions. They can't think. And they are simply doing what Hashem wants them to do. Those who are secular don't believe in Hashem, so they say these things run on their own. They also don't believe that these things are able to choose their own destiny, but they're just moving along and doing what they're supposed to do. The peoples of the world believed that Hashem created objects with great power, but the power that these objects wield, they wield independently of Hashem. So that the sun, although it is not as powerful as Hashem, but the sun wields its power independently. It can make its own decisions. And therefore, I don't need to pray to Hashem for the sun's might and blessings. I can pray to the sun for the sun's blessings. I can pray to the wind for the wind's blessings. I can pray to the rain for the rain's blessings, etc., etc., etc. And that is the, he writes, that is the primary mistake of idolatry. And then eventually, it goes down the line, people even forget about the Hashem part of it and only know about the object. But the primary mistake is not that they forget about Hashem. The primary mistake is to think that these objects, which are really inanimate, have their own choice of what they, how they use their power. And therefore, if they have their own choice, then you should pray to them. So the fact that Abimelech, either before this episode or after this episode, believes in Hashem, does not necessarily dissuade him from his idolatry. Because believing in Hashem was not a direct contradiction to idolatry. Because remember, there's really two parts to believing in Hashem. You got to believe in Hashem. You also have to believe that Hashem is one. Hashem is one means that there aren't any other gods, and that Hashem has no parts to him. He's one uniform being, and there are no parts. And there are no other gods. There's nothing else with independent power but Hashem. So that is something which they didn't believe. And so the fact that he gets a communication from Hashem does not necessarily make him take all of his idols and smash them to smithereens. Although you can imagine he probably was pretty frightened by this whole experience. And there's no question that he certainly has more of an appreciation of what Hashem is after this experience. It is so important to note that he does get this communication, which means that if you were going to say, if from an objective standpoint, who is of a greater level, Abimelech or Paro, you'd have to give the edge to Abimelech, because Abimelech deserves the communication. Paro doesn't get any such communication. So despite the fact that Paro is the king of Mitzrayim, and Abimelech is the king of the Plishtim, who are this twisted descendant of Mitzrayim, nevertheless, Abimelech seems to be on a higher level than Paro. And we will show presently that the Plishtim were on a higher level than the Mitzrim. The subjects of Abimelech were on a higher level than the subjects of Paro, which we'll show in a moment.
I think it's time for Hashem to talk to Abraham and say, let's not stay here if your sister is born.
Okay, so this is considered one of the ten tests again. This is another one of the ten tests.
That seems to contradict their origin.
Right. So this seems to be ironic. Right. So this we need to understand. It seems to be somewhat ironic that the Plishtim seem to be a little bit better off spiritually than the Mitzrim, which is important to note. Now,
well, the sins of Abimelech were innocent.
Okay,
sins.
So
Pharaoh's sins were...
Well, they both thought that she was his sister.
Oh, that. But I mean, what Pharaoh did to the... when he enslaved.
Okay, that didn't happen yet. That's later. Now, our sages explained, Chazal explained regarding this exchange between Hashem and Abimelech, is Abimelech says, I'm innocent. And Hashem says to him, you're innocent of the crime of taking somebody's wife. That's true. What you're not innocent of is creating an atmosphere with what?
The thought,
but more than that, of creating an atmosphere when a married man and woman come to your country and the woman is somewhat attractive, that they need to lie because otherwise they're afraid that you're going to kill him. That you're guilty of. That you're not innocent of. Because why did he have to say she's my sister? That's because of you. So don't tell me that you're completely innocent over here. You are innocent in the sense that you didn't know he was her husband.
That's like the Libby Scooter thing. Scooter Libby thing. He was innocent of not... I mean, he wasn't actually divulging the woman's name, that plain woman, but he was guilty of lying.
He was pushed away. But that was a couple of years ago.
Didn't Abraham feel that that might be a risky thing to say this again when he didn't have very good results from the first time?
The question is whether there was an alternative. As we talked about last time, now he had to do his hishtadlus, he had to do his effort to save his wife over there. Now over there was a famine in the land.
Right.
This time there's no famine. That's true. So that is a good question. Mm-hmm. That is a fair question. I don't have an answer after that for that one. That's a good question. Because over here, don't go there.
Mm-hmm. Why did he go there?
So we said he had to leave the area that he was in, but why go there? That's a good question. Yeah, that's a good question.
Wouldn't the Plishtim have heard the story of Paro doing the same thing?
I guess not. No. That's a good question also. I guess they didn't hear about it. I mean, they didn't know they were married, apparently. Mm-hmm. They hadn't heard of Avraham and Sarah, which is also pretty shocking.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now, in the morning, this is just a fun pasuk to read, a fun verse. We're up to Ches 8. Vayashkem Avimelech baboker. Avimelech woke up early in the morning. That means he didn't sleep late, as kings generally do. He was pretty frightened. He woke up early in the morning. Vayikra l'chol avadav, he called to all of his slaves. Vayidaber eskol advarim bo'ela b'oz Naomi, spoke all these words in their ears. You could say, well, where else do you speak words, but the point is, when the ears closed up, I think they could still hear. I think they were closed, but you know, stopped up. Right. Vayir'uha anashim od, and the men were very scared. And then Vayikra Avimelech LaAvraham, Avimelech calls to Avraham, Vayomelo, and he says to him, Melech Tisalanu, what did you do to us? Omecha Tassilach, what sin did I do to you? Kinevei Salai Vamamachticha Ta'agil Allah, that you brought upon me and my nation a terrible sin. Ma'asim Asher Lo Yeyasu Asisa Yimadi, things that are never done you did to me, meaning I got punished in a way that nobody's ever been punished before. Vayomer Avimelech Al Avraham, Avimelech said to Avraham, Mara Isa, what did you see, Kiyosisa Sadavarasa, that you did this thing? Vayomer Avraham, Avraham said, Kiyamati, for I said, Rak ein yiras Elokim b'makom hazeh, only there is no fear of God in this place. Vaharaguni al davar ishti, and they will kill me on the matter of my wife. As Rashi explains, Avraham said to Avimelech, when you come to a country, what's the first thing you expect to be asked? You're a new person, you walk into the community, what's the first thing you hope that people ask you? Well, the first thing we hope that you'll be asked is, do you have a place to stay?
Yeah.
Do you need some food? Is everything okay? Why are you? Where are you going? Where are you coming from? Not, is this your wife or is this your sister? Mm-hmm. Like, what kind of question is that to ask a guest the first time you see them? So I said, there's no fear of God in this place, and they'll kill me on the matter of my wife.
It makes sense to say, is this your wife? You wouldn't ask, is this your sister? But you would
right. Well, it depends how you say it. Depends how you say it, right? Is this your wife, or hopefully she's your sister, and that kind of thing. Right. So, and then he goes on to explain that, and I'm going to skip ahead over here because of lack of time. He goes on to explain that this is something which Avram says that Sarah has done for him, but wherever they go, she says that she is my sister, I'm her brother. Okay, so then, now we're going to have to stop very soon. So let me just give you a prelude for next week. Let's think this through very carefully. This is the last episode before the birth of Yitzchak. Now think it through. Avram and Sarah have been married for many, many years. They have not had any children. Hashem tells Avram, you're going to have a child. They have a bris. The angels come. Sodom is destroyed. Lot, the whole episode. And now, Sarah is taken by Avimelech. After that, Yitzchak is going to be born. If someone wanted to be cynical, what would they say? Not Avram's child. The child comes from Yitzchak. Yitzchak comes from Avimelech. That's what someone would say. Avimelech is acutely aware of this. Avimelech understands that he can't just give back Sarah, because he understands that, remember, his life is in danger over here. Avimelech knows he better make things right, or he's in big trouble. Hashem himself appears to Avimelech and said, do the right thing here, or you're dead. So Avimelech is looking to make things right. So Avimelech needs to take steps to show the world that he didn't touch Sarah. And so we're going to see the next few verses what happens. And in addition to that, we still haven't answered the question why this episode needs to precede the birth of Yitzchak. How is this episode tied in to the birth of Yitzchak? It seems to be an integral piece to the puzzle. Where does it fit? So next week, Emir Hashem, we're going to start with that, with how Avimelech returns Sarah, and how this episode plays into the birth of Yitzchak, and then, of course, we'll talk about the birth of Yitzchak.